his experience in damming and channeling waters to make his mother's new mountain region livable. We read of these deeds in Tablet 9 of the feats and exploits of Ninurta, as he addresses his mother. Since you, noble lady, alone to the land of landing have gone, since to the land of casting down unafraid you went, a dam I shall heap up for you, so that the land may have a mistress. Completing his irrigation works and bringing over people to perform the required tasks, Ninurta assured his mother that she would have an abundance of vegetation, wood products, and minerals in her mountain abode. Its valleys shall be verdant with vegetation. Its slopes shall produce honey and wine for you, shall produce zabalum trees and boxwood. Its terraces shall be adorned with fruit as a garden. The harsag shall provide you with the fragrance of the gods, shall provide you with the shiny loads. Its mines will as tribute copper and tin give you. Its mountains shall multiply cattle large and small. The harsag shall bring forth the four-legged creatures. This is indeed a befitting description of the Sinai Peninsula, a land of mines, a major source in antiquity of copper, turquoise, and other minerals, a source of the acacia wood, which was used for temple furnishings, a verdant place wherever water was available, a place where flocks could graze. Is it an accident that the principal winter river of the peninsula is still called El Arish, the husbandman, the very nickname Urash of Ninurta? Making a home for his mother in the Sinai's southern region of high granite peaks, Ninurta bestowed on her a new title, Ninharsag, Lady of the Head Mountain. It was the title by which Sud was to be called ever since. The term Head Mountain indicates that it was the highest peak in the area. This is the mountain nowadays known as Mount St. Catherine, a peak revered from antiquity, millennia before the nearby monastery was built. Rising nearby is the slightly lower peak, called by the monks Mount Moses, suggesting that it is the Mount Sinai of the Exodus. Though this is doubtful, the fact remains that the twin peaks have been deemed to be sacred from antiquity. We believe that this was so because they played a pivotal role in the planning of the post-diluvian spaceport and the landing corridor leading to it. These new plans adopted the old principles, and to understand the grand post-diluvian design, we must first review the manner in which the pre-diluvian spaceport and its landing corridor were developed. At that time, the Anunnaki first selected as their focal point the twin-peaked Mount Ararat, the highest peak in Western Asia, and thus the natural landmark most visible from the skies. The next natural and visible features were the Euphrates River and the Persian Gulf. Drawing an imaginary north-south line from Ararat, the Anunnaki determined that the spaceport shall be where the line intersected the river. Then, diagonally to it, from the direction of the Persian Gulf, at a precise angle of 45 degrees, they drew the landing path. They then laid out their first settlements so as to mark out a landing corridor on both sides of the landing path. In the center point, Nippur was established as a mission control center. All the other settlements were equidistant from it, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 25. The post-diluvian space facilities were planned on the same principles. The twin-peaked Mount Ararat served as the major focal point. A line at 45 degrees marked the landing path, and a combination of natural and artificial landmarks outlined an arrow-like landing corridor. The difference was, however, that this time the Anunnaki had at their disposal the ready-made platform in the Cedar Mountain, Baalbek, and they incorporated it into the new landing grid. As before the deluge, the twin-peaked Mount Ararat was to serve again as the northern landmark, anchoring the landing corridor and the landing path in the center of the corridor, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 37. The southern line of the landing corridor was a line connecting the twin-peaked Ararat with the highest peak in the Sinai Peninsula, the Harsag, Mount St. Catherine, and its twin, the slightly lower Mount Moses. The northern line of the landing corridor was a line extending from Ararat through the landing platform of Baalbek and continuing into Egypt. There, the terrain is too flat to offer natural landmarks, and it was thus, we are certain, that the Anunnaki proceeded to build the artificial twin peaks of the two great pyramids of Giza. But where was this anchor to be erected? Here came into play an east-west imaginary line, arbitrarily conceived by the Anunnaki in their space sciences. They arbitrarily divided the skies, enveloping Earth into three bands, or ways. The northern one was the way of Enlil, the southern one the way of Enki, and the central one the way of Anu. Separating them were the lines known to us as the 30th parallel north and the 30th parallel south. The 30th parallel north appears to have been of particular sacred significance. Holy cities from antiquity on, from Egypt to Tibet, have been located on it. It was chosen to be the line on which, at the intersection of the Ararat-Baalbek line, the great pyramids were to be built, and also the line which would indicate, in the Sinai's central plain, the site of the spaceport, SP, a line in the precise middle of the landing corridor, the landing path, was to lead to the exact location of the spaceport on the 30th parallel. This, we believe, is how the landing grid was laid out, how the site of the spaceport was marked off, and how the Great Pyramids of Giza had come into being. By suggesting that the Great Pyramids of Giza were built not by pharaohs, but by the Anunnaki millennia earlier, we of course contradict long-held theories concerning these pyramids. The theory of 19th-century Egyptologists that the Egyptian pyramids, including the unique three at Giza, were erected by a succession of pharaohs as grandiose tombs for themselves, has long been disproven. Not one of them was found to contain the body of the pharaoh who was their known or presumed builder. Accordingly, the Great Pyramid of Giza was supposed to have been built by Khufu, Cheops, its twin by a successor named Khefra, Khefren, and the third, small one, by a third successor, Menkara, Myserinus, all kings of the sixth dynasty. The Sphinx, the same Egyptologists presume, must have been built by Khefren, because it is situated next to a causeway leading to the second pyramid. For a while it was believed that proof had been found in the smallest one of the three pyramids of Giza, and the identity of the pharaoh who had built it established. The credit for this was claimed by a Colonel Howard Weiss and his two assistants, who claimed to have discovered within the pyramid the coffin and mummified remains of the pharaoh Menkara. The fact, however, known to scholars for some time now, but for some reason still hardly publicized, is that neither the wooden coffin nor the skeletal remains were authentic. Someone, undoubtedly that Colonel Weiss and his cronies, had brought into the pyramid a coffin dating from about 2,000 years after Menkara had lived, and bones from the even much later Christian times, and put the two together in an unabashed archaeological fraud. The current theories regarding the pyramid's builders are anchored to an even greater extent on the discovery of the name Khufu, inscribed in hieroglyphics, within a long-sealed compartment within the Great Pyramid, and thus apparently establishing the identity of its builder. Unnoticed has gone the fact that the discoverer of that inscription was the same Colonel Weiss and his assistants. In The Stairway to Heaven, we have put together substantial evidence to show that the inscription was a forgery, perpetrated by its discoverers. At the end of 1983, a reader of that book came forward to provide us with family records showing that his great-grandfather, a master mason named Humphreys Brewer, who was engaged by Weiss to help use gunpowder to blast his way inside the pyramid, was an eyewitness to the forgery, and having objected to the deed, was expelled from the site and forced to leave Egypt altogether. In the Stairway to Heaven, we have shown that Khufu could not have been the builder of the Great Pyramid, because he had already referred to it as existing in his time in a stela he had erected near the pyramids. Even the Sphinx, supposedly erected by the next after successor of Khufu, is mentioned in that inscription. Now we find that pictorial evidence from the time of the pharaohs of the very first dynasty, long before Khufu and his successors, conclusively shows that these early kings had already witnessed the Giza marvels. We can clearly see the Sphinx, both in depictions of the king's journey to the afterlife, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 38A, and in a scene of his investiture by ancient ones arriving in Egypt by boat, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 38B. We also submit in evidence the well-known victory tablet of the very first pharaoh, Menes, which depicts his forceful unification of Egypt. On one side he is shown wearing the white crown of Upper Egypt, defeating its chieftains and conquering their cities. On the other side the tablet shows him, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 39A, wearing the red crown of Lower Egypt, marching through its districts and beheading its chieftains. To the right of his head, the artist spelled out the epithet Narmer, acquired by the king. To the left, the tablet depicts the most important structure in the newly acquired districts, the pyramid, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 39B. All scholars agree that the tablet depicts realistically the places, fortifications, and enemies encountered by Menes in his campaign to unify Upper and Lower Egypt. Yet the pyramid symbol is the only one that appears to have escaped the otherwise careful interpretation. We hold that this symbol, as all others on the tablet, was drawn and included so prominently in the Lower Egypt side because such a structure had actually existed there. The whole Giza complex, pyramids and Sphinx, had thus already existed when kingship began in Egypt. Its builders were not, and could not have been, the pharaohs of the sixth dynasty. The other pyramids of Egypt, smaller, primitive by comparison, some fallen even before completion, all crumbling, had indeed been built by various pharaohs, not as tombs or as cenotaphs, monumental symbolic tombs, but in emulation of the gods, for it was held and believed in antiquity that the Giza pyramids and the Sphinx that accompanies them showed the way to the stairway to heaven, the spaceport in the Sinai Peninsula. Building pyramids so that they might journey to the afterlife, the pharaohs adorned them with appropriate symbols, with illustrations of the journey, and in several instances also covered the walls with quotations from the Book of the Dead. The three pyramids of Giza, unique in their external and internal construction, size, and incredible durability, are also distinguished in that there is no inscription or decoration whatsoever inside them. They are just stark, functional structures, rising from the plain as twin beacons to play a role not in the service of men, but of those who from heaven to earth came. The three pyramids of Giza, we have concluded, were built by first erecting the smaller third pyramid as a scale model. Then, in keeping with the preference for twin-peaked focal points, the two large pyramids were erected. Although the second pyramid is smaller than the Great Pyramid, it appears to be of the same height. This is because it is built on somewhat higher ground, so that to achieve the same height, it need not have been as tall as the first one. Apart from its incomparable size, the Great Pyramid is also unique in that, in addition to the descending passage that is found in all the other pyramids, it has a unique ascending passage, a level corridor, two upper chambers, and a series of narrow compartments, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 40. The uppermost chamber is reached via an incredibly elaborate grand gallery, and an antechamber that could be sealed with one pull of a cord. The uppermost chamber contained, still does, an unusual hollowed-out stone block, whose fashioning required amazing technology, and which rang out as a bell. Above the chamber are the narrow series of low and rugged spaces, offering extreme resonance. What was the purpose of all that? We have found many similarities between these unique features of the Great Pyramid and the pre-diluvian Ikur, house which is like a mountain, of Enlil, his ziggurat in Nippur. Like the Great Pyramid, it rose high to dominate the surrounding plain. In pre-diluvian times, the Ikur of Nippur housed the Duranki, link heaven-earth, and served as mission control center equipped with the Tablets of Destinies, the orbital data panels. It also contained the Durga, a mysterious dark chamber whose radiance guided the shuttlecraft to a landing at Sippar. But all that, the many mysteries and functions of the Ikur described in the Tale of Zu, was before the deluge. When Mesopotamia was re-inhabited and Nippur was re-established, the abode of Enlil and Ninlil, there was a large temple surrounded by courtyards, with gates through which the worshippers could enter. It was no longer forbidden territory. The space-related functions, as the spaceport itself, had shifted elsewhere. As a new mysterious and awesome Ikur, the Sumerian texts described a house which is like a mountain, in a distant place, under the aegis of Ninhursag, not of Enlil. Thus the epic tale of an early post-diluvian Sumerian king named Itana, who was taken aloft toward the celestial abode of the Anunnaki, states that his ascent began not far from the new Ikur, at the place of the eagles, not far, that is, from the spaceport. An Akkadian book of Job, titled Ludlul Bel Namiki, I Praise the Lord of Deepness, refers to the irresistible demon that has exited from the Ikur, in a land across the horizon in the lower world, Africa. Not recognizing the immense antiquity of the Giza pyramids or the identity of their true builders, scholars have also been puzzled by this apparent reference to an Ikur far from Sumer. Indeed, if one is to follow accepted interpretations of Mesopotamian texts, no one in Mesopotamia was ever aware of the existence of the Egyptian pyramids. None of the Mesopotamian kings who invaded Egypt, none of the merchants who traded with her, none of the emissaries who had visited there, not one of them had noticed these colossal monuments. Could that be possible? We suggest that the Giza monuments were known in Sumer and Akkad. We suggest that the Great Pyramid was the post-diluvian Ikur, of which the Mesopotamian texts did speak at length. And we suggest that ancient Mesopotamian drawings depicted the pyramids during their construction and after they had been completed. We have already shown what the Mesopotamian pyramids, the ziggurats or stage towers, looked like, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 24. We find completely different structures on some of the most archaic Sumerian depictions. In some, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 41, we see the construction of a structure with a square base and triangular sides, a smooth-sided pyramid. Other depictions show a completed pyramid, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading 42A, B. With the serpent symbol clearly locating it an Enki territory, and yet another, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 43, endows the completed pyramid with wings to indicate its space-related function. This depiction, of which several were found, shows the pyramid together with other amazingly accurate features: a crouching sphinx facing toward the place of reeds, another sphinx on the other side of the lake of reeds, supporting the suggestion in Egyptian texts that there was another facing the sphinx in the Sinai Peninsula. Both the pyramid and the sphinx near it are located by a river, as the Giza complex is indeed located by the Nile. And beyond all that is the body of water on which the horned gods are sailing, just as the Egyptians had said that their gods had come from the south, via the Red Sea. The striking similarity between this archaic Sumerian depiction and the archaic Egyptian one, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 38A, offers compelling evidence of the common knowledge, in Egypt as in Sumer, of the pyramids and the Sphinx. Indeed, even in such a minor detail as the precise slope of the Great Pyramid, 52 degrees, the Sumerian depiction appears to be accurate. The inevitable conclusion, then, is that the Great Pyramid was known in Mesopotamia, if for no other reason than because it was built by the same Anunnaki who had built the original Iker in Nippur, and likewise, and quite logically, it too was called by them Iker, house which is like a mountain. Like its predecessor, the Great Pyramid of Giza was built with mysterious dark chambers, and was equipped with instruments for guiding the shuttlecraft to the post-diluvian spaceport in the Sinai. And to assure its neutrality, the pyramid was put under the patronage of Ninhursag. Our solution gives meaning to an otherwise enigmatic poem, exalting Ninhursag as mistress of the house with a pointed peak, a pyramid. House bright and dark of heaven and earth, for the rocket ships put together, Iker, house of the gods with pointed peak. For heaven to earth it is greatly equipped, house whose interior glows with a reddish light of heaven, pulsating a beam which reaches far and wide. Its awesomeness touches the flesh. Awesome ziggurat, lofty mountain of mountains, thy creation is great and lofty. Men cannot understand it. The function of this house of the gods with pointed peak is then made clear. It was a house of equipment, serving to bring down to rest the astronauts who see and orbit a great landmark for the lofty Shems, the sky chambers. House of equipment, lofty house of eternity, its foundation are stones which reach the water. Its great circumference is set in the clay. House whose parts are skillfully woven together. House, the rightness of whose howling the great ones who see and orbit brings down to rest. House which is great landmark for the lofty Shem. Mountain by which Utu ascends. House whose deep insides men cannot penetrate. Anu has magnified it. The text then goes on to describe the various parts of the structure, its foundation, which is clad in awe, its entrance, which opens and closes as a mouth, glowing in a dim green light, the threshold, like a great dragon's mouth opened in wait, the door jams, like two edges of a dagger that keeps enemies away, its inner chamber is like a vulva, guarded by daggers which dash from dawn to dusk, its outpouring, that which it emits, is like a lion whom no one dares attack. An ascending gallery is then described. Its vault is like a rainbow. The darkness ends there. In awesomeness it is draped. Its joints are like a vulture whose claws are ready to clasp. There at the top of the gallery is the entryway to the mountain's top. To foe it is not opened, only to them who live. For them it is opened. Three locking devices, the bolt, the bar, and the lock, slithering in an awe-inspiring place, protect the way into the uppermost chamber from which the Iker surveys heaven and earth, a net it spreads out. These are details whose accuracy amazes as one reads them in conjunction with our present knowledge of the insides of the Great Pyramid. The entrance into it was through an opening in its north face, hidden by a swivel stone that indeed opened and closed, like a mouth. Stepping onto a platform, the entrant faced an opening into a descending passage, like a great dragon's mouth opened in wait, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 44A. The gaping entrance was protected from the pyramid's weight above it by two pairs of diagonally placed massive stone blocks, like two edges that keep enemies away, revealing an enigmatic carved stone in the entrance's midst, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 44B. A short distance down the descending passage, an ascending passage began. It led to a horizontal passage through which one could reach the heart of the pyramid, an inner chamber of emissions like a vulva. The ascending passage also led to a majestic ascending gallery, most elaborately constructed, its walls getting closer to each other by stages as they rise, giving the entrant a feeling that these wall joints are like a vulture whose claws are ready to clasp, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 45. The gallery led to the uppermost chamber, from which a net, a force field, surveyed heaven and earth. The way to it was through an antechamber, built with great complexity, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 46, where three locking devices were indeed installed, ready to slither down and to foe, not open. After so describing the ichor inside and out, the laudatory text provides information regarding the functions and location of the structure. On this day, the mistress herself speaks truly. The goddess of the rocket ships, the pure great lady, praises herself. I am the mistress. Anu has determined my destiny. The daughter of Anu am I. Enlil has added to me a great destiny. His sister princess am I. The gods have given unto my hand the pilot guiding instruments of heaven-earth. Mother of the sky chambers am I. Areshkigal allotted to me the place of opening of the pilot guiding instruments. The great landmark, the mountain by which Utu rises, I have established as my dais. If, as we have concluded, Ninhursag was the neutral mistress of the Pyramid of Giza, it follows that she would have been known and revered as a goddess also in Egypt. This indeed is the case, except that to the Egyptians she was known as Hathor. Textbooks will tell us that the name means House of Horus, but that is only superficially correct. The reading stems from the hieroglyphic writing of the name, depicting a house and a falcon, the falcon having been the symbol of Horus because he could soar as a falcon. What the goddess's name literally meant was, goddess whose home is where the falcons are, where the astronauts make their home, the spaceport. This spaceport, we have determined, was located in the post-diluvian era in the Sinai Peninsula. Accordingly, the title Hathor, home of the falcons, would require that the goddess bearing it should be mistress of the Sinai Peninsula. That, indeed, she was. The Egyptians considered the Sinai Peninsula to have been the domain of Hathor. All the temples and stela erected by Egyptian pharaohs in the peninsula were dedicated exclusively to this goddess. And like Ninhursag in her later years, Hathor too was nicknamed the cow and was depicted with cow's horns. But was Hathor also, as we have claimed for Ninhursag, mistress of the Great Pyramid? That, amazingly but not surprisingly, she was. The evidence comes in the form of an inscription by the pharaoh Khufu on a commemorative stela he erected at Giza in a temple dedicated to Isis. Known as the Inventory Stela, the monument and its inscription clearly established that the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx had already existed when Khufu, Cheops, began to reign. All he claimed was to have built the temple to Isis beside the already existing pyramid and sphinx. Live Horus Mesdau, to king of Upper and Lower Egypt, Khufu, life is given. He founded the house of Isis, mistress of the pyramid, beside the house of the sphinx. At his time, when Isis, the wife of Osiris and the mother of Horus, was considered to have been the mistress of the pyramid, but as the continuing inscription makes clear, she was not the pyramid's first mistress. Live Horus Mesdau, to king of Upper and Lower Egypt Khufu, life is given, for his divine mother Isis, mistress of the western mountain of Hathor, he made this writing on a stela. Thus, not only was the pyramid a mountain of Hathor, the exact parallel of the Sumerian house, which is like a mountain, but also it was her western mountain, implying that she also had an eastern one. That, we know from the Sumerian sources, was the Harsag, the highest peak in the Sinai Peninsula. In spite of the rivalry and suspicions between the two divine dynasties, there is little doubt that the actual work of constructing the spaceport and the control and guidance facilities fell into the hands of Enki and his descendants. Ninurta proved himself capable of damming and irrigation works. Utu Shamash knew how to command and operate the landing and takeoff facilities. But only Enki, the master engineer and scientist who had been through all this before, had the required know-how and experience for planning the massive construction works and supervising their execution. There is not even a hint in Sumerian texts that describe the achievements of Ninurta and Utu that either one of them had planned or engaged in space-related construction works. When Ninurta, in later times, called upon a Sumerian king to build him a ziggurat with a special enclosure for his divine bird, it was another god, accompanying Ninurta, who gave the king the architectural plans and building instructions. On the other hand, several texts reported that Enki had passed to his son Marduk the scientific knowledge he had possessed. The texts report a conversation between father and son after Marduk had approached his father with a difficult question. Enki answered his son Marduk, "My son, what is it you do not know? What more could I give to you? Marduk, what is it that you do not know? What could I give you in addition? Whatever I know, you know." Since the similarities between Ptah and Enki as the father, and Marduk and Ra as son are so strong, we should not be surprised at all to find that Egyptian texts did connect Ra with space facilities and with related construction works. In this, he was assisted by Shu and Tefnut, Geb and Nut, and Thoth, the god of magical things. The Sphinx, the divine guide that showed the way eastward exactly along the 30th parallel, bore the features of Hor-Akhti, Falcon of the Horizon, the epithet for Ra. A stela erected near the Sphinx in pharaonic times bore an inscription that directly named Ra as the engineer, extender of the cord, who built the protected place in the sacred desert, from which he could ascend beautifully and traverse the skies. "Thou extendest the cords for the plan. Thou didst give form to the lands. Thou didst make secret the lower world. Thou hast built for thee a place protected in the sacred desert with hidden name. Thou risest by day opposite them. Thou art rising beautifully. Thou art crossing the sky with a good wind. Thou art traversing the sky in the celestial bark. The sky is jubilating. The earth is shouting of joy. The crew of Ra do praising every day. He comes forth in triumph." Egyptian texts asserted that Shu and Tefnut were involved in Ra's extensive space-related works by upholding the skies over earth. Their son Geb bore a name that stemmed from the root gub, to pile up, to heap up, attesting, scholars agree, to his engaging in works that entailed piling up, a strong suggestion of his involvement in the actual construction of the pyramids. An Egyptian tale concerning the pharaoh Khufu and his three sons reveals that in those days the secret plans of the Great Pyramid were in the custody of the god whom the Egyptians called Thoth, the god of astronomy, mathematics, geometry, and land surveying. It will be recalled that a unique feature of the Great Pyramid was its upper chambers and passages. However, because these passages were sealed off, we shall show how, when, and why, just where they branch off from the descending passage, all the pharaohs who attempted to emulate the Giza pyramids built theirs with lower chambers only, being either unable to emulate the upper chambers for lack of precise architectural knowledge, or in time, simply unaware of their existence. But Khufu, it seems, was aware of the existence of these two secret chambers within the Great Pyramid, and at one point was on the verge of discovering the plans of their construction, for he was told where the god Thoth had hidden them. Written on the so-called Westcar papyrus, entitled Tales of the Magicians, the tale relates that one day, when King Khufu reigned over all the land, he called in his three sons and asked them to tell him tales of the deeds of the magicians of olden times. First to speak was the royal son Khafra, who related a tale of the days of thy Khufu's forefather Nebka, of what came to pass when he went into the temple of Ptah. It was a tale of how a magician brought a dead crocodile back to life. Then the royal son, Bau-F-Ra, told of a miracle in the days of Khufu's earlier forefather, when a magician parted the waters of a lake so that a jewel could be retrieved from its bottom. And then the magician spake and used his magic speech, and he brought the water of all the lake again to its place. Somewhat cynical, the third son, Hor-di-Def, arose and spoke, saying, "We have heard about the magicians of the past and their doings, the truth of which we cannot verify. Now I know things done in our time." The pharaoh Khufu asked what they were, and Hor-di-Def answered that he knew of a man named Dedi, who knew how to replace a decapitated head, to tame a lion, and who also knew the Padut numbers of the chambers of Thoth. Hearing this, Khufu became extremely curious, for he had been seeking to find out the secret of the chambers of Thoth in the Great Pyramid, already blocked and hidden in Khufu's time. So he ordered that the sage Dedi be found and fetched from his abode, an island off the tip of the Sinai Peninsula. When Dedi was brought before the pharaoh, Khufu first tested his magical powers, such as bringing back to life a goose, a bird, and an ox, whose heads were cut off. Then Khufu asked, "Is it true what is said that thou knowest the Padut numbers for the Eput of Thoth?" And Dedi answered, "I know not the numbers, O king, but I know the place the Padut are in." Egyptologists are by and large agreed that Eput conveyed the meaning secret chambers of the primeval sanctuary, and Padut meant designs, plans with numbers. Answering Khufu, the magician, his age was given as 110 years, said, "I know not the information in the designs, O king, but I know where the plans with numbers were hidden by Thoth." In answer to further questioning, he said, "There is a box of whetstone in the sacred chamber called the Chart Room in Heliopolis. They are in that box." Excited, Khufu ordered Dedi to go and find the box for him, but Dedi answered that it was neither he nor Khufu who could obtain the box. It was destined to be found by a future descendant of Khufu. This, he said, was decreed by Ra. Yielding to the god's will, Khufu ended up only building near the Sphinx a temple dedicated to the mistress of the pyramid. The circle of evidence is thus complete. Sumerian and Egyptian texts confirm each other, and our conclusions. The same neutral goddess was the mistress of Sinai's highest peak, and of the artificial mountain erected in Egypt, both to serve as anchors of the landing corridor. But the Anunnaki's desire to keep the Sinai Peninsula and its facilities neutral did not prevail for long. Rivalry and love tragically combined to upset the status quo, and the divided earth was soon embroiled in the Pyramid Wars. Chapter 8. The Pyramid Wars. In the year 363, His Majesty Ra, the Holy One, the Falcon of the Horizon, the Immortal who forever lives, was in the land of Ken. He was accompanied by his warriors, for the enemies had conspired against their lord, Horus. The winged measurer came to the boat of Ra. He said to his forefather, "O Falcon of the Horizon, I have seen the enemy conspire against thy lordship, to take the luminous crown unto themselves. Then Ra, the Holy One, the Falcon of the Horizon, said unto Horus, the Winged Measurer, Lofty issue of Ra, my begotten, go quickly, knock down the enemy whom you have seen. Thus began the tale inscribed on the temple walls in the ancient Egyptian city of Edfu. It is the tale, we believe, of what could only be called the First Pyramid War, a war that had its roots in the never-ending struggle for control over Earth and its space facilities, and in the shenanigans of the great Anunnaki, especially Enki, Ptah, and his son Ra, Marduk. According to Manetho, Ptah turned over the dominion over Egypt after a reign of 9,000 years, but the reign of Ra was cut short after 1,000 years, by the deluge, we have concluded. Then there followed a reign of 700 years by Shu, who helped Ra control the skies over Earth, and the 500-year reign of Geb, who piles up the Earth. It was at that time, circa 10,000 B.C., that the space facilities, the spaceport in the Sinai and the Giza pyramids, were built. Although the Sinai Peninsula, where the spaceport was established, and the Giza pyramids were supposed to remain neutral under the aegis of Ninhursag, it is doubtful whether the builders of these facilities, Enki and his descendants, had really any intention of relinquishing control over these installations. A Sumerian text, which begins with an idyllic description, has been named by scholars a paradise myth. Its ancient name was Enki and Ninhursag, and it is in fact a record of the politically motivated lovemaking between the two, a tale of a deal between Enki and his half-sister Ninhursag pertaining to the control of Egypt and the Sinai Peninsula, of the pyramids and the spaceport. The tale's time is after Earth was apportioned between the Anunnaki, with Tilmun, the Sinai Peninsula, granted to Ninhursag, and Egypt to Enki's clan. It was then, the Sumerian tale relates, that Enki crossed the marshy lakes that separated Egypt and the Sinai Peninsula, and came unto the lonely Ninhursag for an orgy of lovemaking, to the one who is alone, to the Lady of Life. Mistress of the land, Enki came unto the wise Lady of Life. He causes his phallus to water the dikes. He causes his phallus to submerge the reeds. He poured his semen into the great lady of the Anunnaki, poured the semen in the womb of Ninhursag. She took the semen into the womb, the semen of Enki. Enki's real intention was to obtain a son by his half-sister, but the offspring was a daughter. Enki then made love to the daughter as soon as she became young and fair, and then to his granddaughter. As a result of these sexual activities, a total of 8 gods, 6 female and 2 male, were born. Angered by the incest, Ninhursag used her medical skills to sicken Enki. The Anunnaki who were with him pleaded for his life, but Ninhursag was determined, "Until he is dead, I shall not look upon him with the eye of life." Satisfied that Enki had indeed been finally stopped, Ninurta, who went to Tilmun for inspection, returned to Mesopotamia to report the developments at a meeting attended by Enlil, Nana, Sin, Utu, Shamash, and Inanna, Ishtar. Unsatisfied, Enlil ordered Ninurta to return to Tilmun and bring back Ninhursag with him. But in the interim, Ninhursag had pity on her brother and changed her mind. Ninhursag seated Enki by her vulva and asked, "My brother, what hurts thee?" After she cured his body part by part, Enki proposed that the two of them, as masters of Egypt and the Sinai, assign tasks, spouses, and territories to the 8 young gods. Let Abu be the master of the plants. Let Nintula be the lord of Magan. Let Ninsutu marry Ninazu. Let Ninkashi be she who sates the thirsts. Let Nazi marry Nindara. Let Azimua marry Ningishzida. Let Nintu be the queen of the months. Let Inshag be the lord of Tilmun. Egyptian theological texts from Memphis likewise held that there came into being 8 gods from the heart, tongue, teeth, lips, and other parts of the body of Ptah. In this text, too, as in the Mesopotamian one, Ptah followed up the bringing forth of these gods by assigning abodes and territories to them. After he had formed the gods, he made cities, established districts, put the gods in their sacred abodes. He built their shrines and established their offerings. All that he did to make rejoice the heart of the mistress of life. If, as it appears, these tales had a basis in fact, then the rivalries that such confused parentages brought about could only be aggravated by the sexual shenanigans attributed to Ra as well. The most significant among these was the assertion that Osiris was truly the son of Ra and not of Geb, conceived when Ra had come by stealth unto his own granddaughter. This, as we have earlier related, lay at the core of the Osiris-Seth conflict. Why had Seth, to whom Upper Egypt had been allotted by Geb, coveted Lower Egypt, which was granted to Osiris? Egyptologists have offered explanations in terms of geography, the land's fertility, etc. But as we have shown, there was one more factor, one that, from the gods' point of view, was more important than how many crops a region could grow. The Great Pyramid and its companions at Giza, whoever controlled them, shared in the control of the space activities, of the comings and goings of the gods, of the vital supply link to and from the 12th planet. For a while, Seth succeeded in his ambition, having outwitted Osiris. But in the year 363, following the disappearance of Osiris, the young Horus became the avenger of his father and launched a war against Seth. The First Pyramid War. It was also the first war in which the gods involved men in their struggles. Supported by other Inki gods reigning in Africa, the avenger Horus began the hostilities in Upper Egypt. Aided by the winged disk that Thoth had fashioned for him, Horus persistently advanced northward, toward the pyramids. A major battle took place in the Water District, the chain of lakes that separates Egypt from the Sinai Peninsula, and a good many of Seth's followers were slain. After peacemaking efforts by other gods had failed, Seth and Horus engaged in personal combat in and over the Sinai Peninsula. In the course of one battle, Seth hid in secret tunnels somewhere in the peninsula. In another battle, he lost his testicles. So the Council of the Gods gave the whole of Egypt as heritage to Horus. And what had become of Seth, one of the 8 gods descended from Ptah? He was banished from Egypt and took up abode in Asiatic lands to the east, including a place that enabled him to speak out from the sky. Was he the god called Inshag in the Sumerian tale of Inki and Ninhursag, the one to whom Tilmun, the Sinai Peninsula, was allotted by the 2 lovemakers? If so, then he was the Egyptian, Hamitic, god, who had extended his domain over the land of Shem, later known as Canaan. It was in this outcome of the First Pyramid War that there lies an understanding of biblical tales. Therein also lay the causes of the Second Pyramid War. In addition to the spaceport and the guidance facilities, there was also a need after the deluge for a new mission control center to replace the one that had existed before in Nippur. We have shown that the need to equidistance this center from the other space-related facilities dictated its locating on Mount Moriah, the Mount of Directing, the site of the future city of Jerusalem. That site, by both Mesopotamian and biblical accounts, was located in the lands of Shem, the dominion of the Enlilites. Yet it ended up under an illegal occupation by the line of Enki, the Hamitic gods, and by the descendants of the Hamitic Canaan. The Old Testament refers to the land of which Jerusalem in time became the capital as Canaan, after the 4th and youngest son of Ham. It also singled out Canaan for special rebuke and consigned his descendants to be subservient to the descendants of Shem. The improbable excuse for this treatment was that Ham, not his son Canaan, had inadvertently seen the naked genitals of his father Noah. Therefore the Lord had put a curse upon Canaan. Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. Blessed be Yahweh, the God of Shem. May Canaan be a servant unto them. The tale in the book of Genesis leaves many aspects unexplained. Why was Canaan accursed if it was his father who had accidentally transgressed? Why was his punishment to be a slave of Shem and to the God of Shem? And how were the gods involved in the crime and its punishment? As one reads the supplemental information in the ex-biblical Book of Jubilees, it becomes clear that the real offense was the illegal occupation of Shem's territory. After mankind was dispersed and its various clans allotted their lands, the Book of Jubilees relates, Ham and his sons went to the land which he was to occupy, the land which he acquired as his portion in the country of the south. But then, journeying from where Noah had been saved to his allotted land in Africa, Canaan saw the land of Lebanon all the way down to the river of Egypt, that it was very good. And so he changed his mind. He went not into the land of his inheritance to the west of the sea, west of the Red Sea. He dwelt instead in the land of Lebanon, eastward and westward of the Jordan. His father and his brothers tried to dissuade Canaan from such an illegal act, and Ham his father, and Cush and Mizraim his brothers, said unto him, Thou hast settled in a land which is not thine, and which did not fall to us by lot. Do not do so, for if thou dost do so, thou and thy sons will be fallen in the land, and be accursed through sedition. For by sedition ye have settled, and by sedition will thy children fall, and thou shalt be rooted out forever. Dwell not in the dwelling of Shem, for to Shem and his sons did it come by their lot. Were he to illegally occupy the territory assigned to Shem, they pointed out, cursed art thou, and cursed shalt thou be beyond the sons of Noah, by the curse which we bound ourselves by an oath in the presence of the holy judge, and in the presence of Noah, our father. But Canaan did not hearken unto them, and dwelt in the land of Lebanon from Hamath to the entering of Egypt, he and his sons until this day. For this reason is that land named Canaan. Behind the biblical and pseudo-epigraphical tale of a territorial usurpation by a descendant of Ham must lie a tale of a similar usurpation by a descendant of the god of Egypt. We must bear in mind that at the time the allotment of lands and territories was not among the peoples, but among the gods. The gods, not the people, were the landlords. A people could only settle a territory allotted to their god, and could occupy another's territory only if their god had extended his or her dominion to that territory, by agreement or by force. The illegal seizure of the area between the spaceport and the Sinai and the landing place in Baalbek by a descendant of Ham could have occurred only if that area had been usurped by a descendant of the Hamitic deities, by a younger god of Egypt. And that, as we have shown, was indeed the result of the First Pyramid War. Seth's trespass into Canaan meant that all the space-related sites, Giza, the Sinai Peninsula, Jerusalem, came under the control of the Inki gods. It was a development in which the Enlilites could not acquiesce. And so, soon thereafter, 300 years later, we believe, they deliberately launched a war to dislodge the illegal occupiers from the vital space facilities. This Second Pyramid War is described in several texts, some found in the original Sumerian, others in Akkadian and Assyrian renderings. Scholars refer to these texts as the myths of Kerr, myths of the mountain lands. They are, in fact, poetically rendered chronicles of the war to control the space-related peaks, Mount Moriah, the Harsag, Mount St. Catherine, in the Sinai, and the artificial mount, the Iker, the Great Pyramid in Egypt. It is clear from the texts that the Enlilite forces were led and commanded by Ninurta, Enlil's foremost warrior, and that the first encounters were in the Sinai Peninsula. The Hamitic gods were beaten there, but they retreated to continue the war from the mountain lands of Africa. Ninurta rose to the challenge, and in the second phase of the war carried the battle to the strongholds of his foes. That phase entailed vicious and ferocious battles. Then, in its final phase, the war was fought at the Great Pyramid, the last and impregnable stronghold of Ninurta's opponents. There, the Hamitic gods were besieged until they ran out of food and water. This war, which we call the Second Pyramid War, was commemorated extensively in Sumerian records, both written chronicles and pictorial depictions. Hymns to Ninurta contain numerous references to his feats and heroic deeds in this war. A great part of the psalm, "Like Anu Art Thou Made," is devoted to a record of the struggle and the final victory. But the principal and most direct chronicle of the war is the epic text, Lugal-i Ud Melam B, best collated and edited by Samuel Geller in Altorientalische Texte und Untersuchungen. Like all Mesopotamian texts, it is so titled after its opening line, King, the glory of thy day is lordly. Ninurta, foremost, possessor of the divine powers, who into the throes of the mountain land stepped forth. Like a flood which cannot be stopped, the enemy land as with a girdle you tightly bound. Foremost one who in battle vehemently enters. Hero, who in his hand the divine brilliant weapon carries. Lord, the mountain land you subdued as your creature. Ninurta, royal son whose father to him had given might. Hero, in fear of thee, the city has surrendered. O mighty one, the great serpent, the heroic god, you tore away from all the mountains. Thus extolling Ninurta, his feats, and his brilliant weapon, the poem also describes the location of the conflict, the mountain lands, and his principal enemy, the great serpent, leader of the Egyptian deities. The Sumerian poem identifies this adversary several times as Azag, and once refers to him as Asher. Both well-known epithets for Marduk, thereby establishing the two principal sons of Enlil and Enki, Ninurta and Marduk, as the leaders of the opposing camps in the Second Pyramid War. The second tablet, one of 13 on which the long poem was inscribed, describes the first battle. Ninurta's upper hand is ascribed to both his godly weapons and a new airship that he built for himself after his original one had been destroyed in an accident. It was called Imdugud, usually translated Divine Stormbird, but which literally means that which like heroic storm runs. We know from various texts that its wingspan was about 75 feet. Archaic drawings depicted it as a mechanically constructed bird with two wing structures supported by crossbeams, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 47A. An undercarriage reveals a series of round openings, perhaps air intakes for jet-like engines. This aircraft, from millennia ago, bears a remarkable resemblance not only to the early biplanes of the modern air age, but also an incredible likeness to the sketch made in 1497 by Leonardo da Vinci, depicting his concept of a man-powered flying machine, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 47B. The Imdugud was the inspiration for Ninurta's emblem, a heroic lion-headed bird resting on two lions, which can be found in the bonus PDF under the heading Figure 48, or sometimes on two bulls. It was in this crafted ship, a manufactured vehicle, that which in war destroys the princely abodes, that Ninurta soared into the skies during the battles of the Second Pyramid War. He soared so high that his companions lost sight of him. Then the texts relate, in his winged bird, against the walled abode, he swooped down. As his bird neared the ground, the summit of the enemy's stronghold, he smashed. chased out of his strongholds, the enemy began to retreat. While Ninurta kept up the frontal attack, Adad roamed the countryside behind the enemy lines, destroying the adversary's food supplies. In the Abzu, Adad the fish caused to be washed away, the cattle he dispersed. When the enemy kept retreating into the mountains, the two